And so our second speaker this morning is Brandon Pass from the University of Toronto, and he's going to tell us about the multi-marginal optimal transportation problem.
Okay, so first of all, thank you to the organizers for giving me this opportunity to speak here. So I'm going to talk about the multi-marginal optimal transportation problem. And so to help illustrate this problem, it's useful to think of a large construction company. And this company employs a lot of plumbers, a lot of carpenters, and a lot of electricians, say. And they want to build a lot of houses. And to build one house, they have to assign one carpenter and one electrician and one plumber to it. And those people sort of make a team and build that house. And so there are, of course, a lot of different ways they can make these teams, a lot of different combinations. And some people work more or less well together. And so depending on how they make these teams, the overall efficiency may be higher or lower. And so what the company wants to do is to make these teams in such a way that this efficiency is as high as possible. Okay. So what we're going to do is we're going to take Borel probability measures. On, say, smooth manifolds. And we'll call the dimensions mi, or n sub I. So what sort of the connection with the construction company is you assume the skill sets of each type of tradesperson can be parameterized by some manifold mi. And then mu I is sort of the distribution of that type of tradesperson, right? And I equals 1, 2, up to m. And so m is like the number of types of tradespeople you're dealing with. And we have a surplus function. So S maps the product, m1 cross m2, all the way up to m sub m, to the real numbers. And so we call this the smooth, we call this the surplus function. And so a point in this product is like you're taking one carpenter, one electrician, and one plumber. And so that's like you've made a team. And so S sort of represents the efficiency of that team. And now the problem that we want to do is we want to maximize this overall efficiency. So there's at least two formulations of this problem. And one is the Monge formulation. And what you want to do there is you want to maximize the integral of S, x1, f2 of x1, right, so you want to maximize this integral against the first marginal. So this is an integral over m1. And you want to do this among sort of m tuple, m minus 1 tuples of maps that push this first marginal to each of the other marginals. M minus 1 tuples F2, F3 up to Fm. So each Fi maps M1 to Mi. And Fi pushes mu1 to mu I. So. And so if you think about, say you think about M1 as being your space of carpenters and M2 is your space of electricians, then F2 of X1 is like the electrician that carpenter X1 will work with. Right? Okay. And so like in the two-marginal problem, there's another formulation of this called the Kantorovich formulation. And now we want to maximize the integral of S, X. So if I write X without a subscript, I just mean a point in the product M1 cross M2 all the way up to Mm. So now we want to maximize this among measures gamma. And so here, gamma is going to be a measure on the product. And gamma should project via the canonical projections to each of the new i's, so such that gamma projects to each. Okay, and so I guess, like in the two marginal case, the difference between the Kantorovich and the Monge formulation is here a piece of mass, or in this case, in our interpretation, a carpenter can get split among two or more plumbers, right? So a carpenter could spend part of his time working with one plumber and part of his time working with another. Okay. So under mild conditions, you can show that a Kantorovich solution exists. Let's call it Kantorovich solution gamma. Okay, and so when m equals 2, so when we just have two marginals, and we assume, let's assume the dimensions of the two spaces are the same, then this is a problem which should have, of course, has received a lot of attention. And the theme of what happens in this problem is sort of captured by this theorem here. And if we assume that, so if we assume that S is twisted, and by that I mean you fix x1 and you map x2 to the differential with respect to x1. And you assume that this map is 1-to-1. So assume that, and assume that the first marginal is absolutely continuous with respect to local coordinates. Then in that case, your solution down here is actually concentrated on the graph of a function over x1. And so that means that that solution gives you a solution to the Monge problem. And in this case, you can also show that your solution is unique. Okay. And so another result, which is slightly different but in some sense analogous, is this result of Robert McCann, myself, and Micah Warren. And now we assume that S is non-degenerate. And so by that I just mean this map here is non-degenerate. And I'll remind you what that map is. So this is going to be a bilinear map on the tangent space of xi, tangent space of mi at xi, and the tangent space of mj at xj. And it's going to take d by dxi and d by dxj to the mixed second order partial. Okay, so d by dxi alpha here, I guess, in theta, right, of xi alpha d by dx. Beta, right? And so we assume this thing's non-degenerate, which in local coordinates just means this matrix of mixed second-order partial derivatives is invertible. Okay, so if we assume that condition, then we can actually conclude that the support of gamma is contained in an n-dimensional Lipschitz submanifold of the product space. And so one thing that's interesting about this is we didn't take any conditions on the marginals here, and we didn't have this injectivity, this twisted condition up here. We replace it with this non-degeneracy condition, which is like a local or linearized version of the twist condition, because this map is essentially the derivative of that map up there. Okay, and so we actually were able to say something under no conditions on the marginals and weaker conditions, well, not exactly weaker, but sort of localized conditions on S. And something else that's interesting about that is there's been a lot of attention lately into understanding when this cost or when this function here that solves the Monge problem is continuous or smoother or better than continuous. And it turns out to ensure that you need strong conditions on S and some conditions as well on the marginals. And so down here we actually say it's contained in a Lipschitz submanifold. So we're able to say something about the continuity without any conditions on the marginals and pretty weak conditions on S, as long as we're willing to look at it as sort of a submanifold of the product rather than a graph. Okay. Okay, but the overall idea I want to get across with this slide is that when m equals 2, solutions are small. So solutions assuming these two dimensions are the same, are n-dimensional, right? Either you have a map or an n-dimensional submanifold. Okay. And so that sort of raises the question for m greater than or equal to 3. What does gamma look like? Is the most vague question you could ask. So do you have Monge solutions? In other words, is gamma concentrated on graphs, like in the Monge formulation? Is gamma unique? And an analog down here, I guess, is what's the support, or what's the dimension of the support? And this is the sort of question I'm going to spend most of my time talking about. Okay. So some things are known about this problem. So the first major result, I guess, is due to Gangbo and Switch in 1998. And they say, in the case when each MI is n-dimensional Euclidean space, and they take this special surplus function, so S is just the modulus of, or the norm squared of the sum, and then they assume this condition that we've already seen, where the first marginal is absolutely continuous with respect to local coordinates. And in that case, they can actually show that gamma induces a Monge solution and is unique, much like people were able to show in the two marginal case. Okay. And so then, in 2002, Hynek generalized this slightly. Instead of taking this norm squared function, he said you can take any strictly convex function of the sum. And then the conclusion is the same, that you get a Monge solution and it's unique. Okay. And then Carlier generalized this more, but only in the case when n equals 1. So now each MI is equal to the real line. And he said, in that case, if S is strictly 2 monotone, which basically means all these mixed second order partials, d squared S, dxi, dxj, basically if all these are positive, then in that case, you can make the same conclusion. You get a Monge solution, and it's unique. And then a result with a slightly different flavor was due to Carlier and Nazareth in 2008. They said, now, we're still assuming MI is RN, but we're going to now assume the number of marginals in that dimension N are the same. And in that case, you can actually take all the XIs and write them in a matrix, and that matrix will be N by N, because N and M are the same. And we're going to make the surplus function equal to the determinant of that matrix. Okay. And when you do this, it turns out that gamma may not be concentrated on the graph of a function, and it actually may not be unique as well. And so in one sense, this is surprising at first glance, but then on the other hand, it's not really surprising, because if you look at this surplus function, it doesn't satisfy naive sort of generalizations of this twist and non-degeneracy condition. So in some sense, this is sort of a degenerate surplus function. Okay. So, okay, so my main theorem is, well, I'm going to state my main theorem. So take a point x in the product. And let G belong to capital G. So I haven't told you what this set capital G is. I'll just say for now that this is some set of symmetric bilinear forms on this product space. So it's some set of like semi-Riemannian metrics. Okay. So take something in there, and if it's a semi-Riemannian metric, it has a signature, basically the number of positive, negative, and zero eigenvalues in local coordinates. So let the signature of G at X be, so let's call it lambda plus lambda minus, I'll call it n minus lambda plus minus lambda minus. And so n here, n is just like the total dimension of this product, so it's just the sum of the ni's. All right, so let this be the signature. So we have sort of lambda plus space-like directions, lambda minus time-like directions, and this many light-like directions. Okay, so then the conclusion is near X, the support of gamma is contained in a Lipschitz submanifold, and its dimension is essentially the number of space-like or light-like directions that you have here. So that turns out to be n minus lambda minus. And morally, what's really going on is you don't necessarily know that this thing is, this support gamma is smooth or differentiable, but really morally what's going on is that it's space-like. So if this support is differentiable at this point, it is space-like there. And so by that I just mean that GVV is greater than or equal to zero for all V in the tangent space of support gamma at X. Right, so I need to tell you what this set G is. Yeah. No assumptions on the measures, no. Okay, so G is going to be a convex set, and it's going to be generated by a finite number of extreme points. So G is, let's say, the set of lambda P GP. So P is in some index set capital P, and each lambda is between 0 and 1, and their sum is 1. Okay, and okay, so now I need to tell you what this index set is and what these GPs are. So this index set, here is the set of partitions of the numbers 1, 2, 3, all the way up to m. Partitions of this set into two non-empty disjoint subsets. Right. So if a little p is in capital P, then basically little p is like, well, we can represent it as an ordered pair or a set of two elements, P0 and P1. And P0 here, well, these are both, P0 and P1 are both subsets of this, and their disjoint union is the whole thing. And, well, their intersection is empty, and neither one of them is empty. Right. Okay. And so now for each set in this sort of index set P, I have one of these forms. Maybe I should just point out this is a finite set because it's, you know, partitions of a finite thing. And you can actually compute the size of this set and it turns out to be 2 to the m minus 1 minus 1. Can I write on the next line down? Yeah. Okay, so, right, I have to tell you what the GPs are. So GP is just going to be the sum where I is in P0 and J is in P1 of D squared by XJS plus the opposite thing, just to make it symmetric. This thing. Okay, and so now I guess I've defined everything, but it looks a little abstract. So I'm going to give you an example of something that's in that set. So if you take all these weightings, lambda p, to be equal, so you take them all to be 1 over the size of that set, then it turns out that what you get is just the sum of I not equal to j of d squared xi xjs up to some positive constant. And so this thing you can represent as a matrix. You're just going to have zeros on the diagonal and on the off-diagonal, so acting on the tangent space of x1 and x2, you're going to get something like this d squared x1 x2s, and then all sort of similar terms up to this x1 xms. And over here, you get d squared x2 x1s. And you just get zeros down the diagonal like that. So basically, what you have is it looks just like the Hessian of the function or the second derivative of the function s. But we've just taken these diagonal blocks. So this is like an n1 by n1 block. And we've replaced what would be the Hessian of s with respect to the first variable with this zero. Okay, so that's the example of something that's in there. And now, no, they'll generally be different. But this, yes, you don't know that's the dimension. Yeah. Not yet. No. Right, so in principle, I mean, they could be anything, and you get some funny g. Yeah, yeah. Well, the ones on the diagonal are, yeah. Yeah. Right. So, let's think about the m equals 2 case for a minute. So when I take m equals 2, it turns out there's only one thing in this set capital P. And that means there's only one thing in this big set capital G. And that thing is just this G bar. And that looks like this. And this is just the pseudometric of Kim and McCann that they used to study the sectional, well, whose sectional curvatures they use to study the regularity of optimal maps. And they actually noted that the signature is NN0 as long as S is non-degenerate, so as long as this thing's non-degenerate. So if S is non. And so what our theorem tells us here is that everything, the support of the solution, is contained in an n-dimensional Lipschitz submanifold. And that's just exactly this result I put up on a slide earlier with Robert and Micah. But actually, our theorem here tells us a little bit more, even for two marginal problems, because in our theorem, we don't assume that the two dimensions are the same. And if the two dimensions are the same, we don't assume that this thing's non-degenerate. So a more general statement that comes from this is, more generally, if R is the rank of this thing here, then the signature of G bar is R, and whatever's left, which is N1 plus N2 minus 2R. And so in that case, our solution is contained in an N1 plus N2 minus R-dimensional manifold. Okay. Okay. So let's look at some other examples. So let's look at this case of that I put up on the first slide of Gangbo and Schweich and Hynek. So when I assume that MI is RN and S of X is H of the sum. So I equals 1 to M. Okay, so in this case, G bar is just 0, D squared H, D squared H, D squared H everywhere. And zeros down the diagonal. And so, if H is convex, or uniformly convex, so if D squared H is bigger than 0, then the signature of this is N, M minus 1, N, 0. And so in that case, our theorem tells us that the solution is contained in an n-dimensional Lipschitz submanifold, which is at least consistent with the result of Gangbo and Schweich and Hynek, and says something slightly different, right? Okay. But now what happens if we take d squared h to be less than 0, so we take h to be strictly concave? Well, then the signature of this thing is basically the opposite of this, right? So it's going to be M minus 1 times N, N, 0. And so our theorem tells us that the solution's contained in an M minus 1 times N dimensional manifold. So this is a really high dimension, right? And so that's a little bit strange, or seems a little bit strange. But it turns out you can actually build solutions that are supported on these high-dimensional manifolds. And the reason for that is that a concave function can have a maximum, unlike a convex function. So h here is a function from Rn to R, right? So say h is maximized at y. So y is a point in Rn. Constant point, then if you look at the surface or the hyperplane where you take x1 plus x2 plus all the way up to xm and you set them equal to this constant y, that's an m minus 1 times n dimensional submanifold. And if you put any measure on that surface and then project it down to its marginals, well, you integrate a probability, you integrate S against that measure, you get some value. And you integrate S against any other possible measure, and you have to get a lower value, right? Because H is maximized on this surface, right? So this surface is the support of a maximizer. Well, let's say then any measure, any gamma supported on this surface is optimal for its marginals. Okay. So, yeah.
When you wrote down the Monza controls for when you were maximizing the...
Right. Right. Are you saying I have concave and convex mixed up, maybe?
No, I just want to say, because the dimensions become the same when it's
Yeah, M minus 1 is 1.
So this means, okay, so we are still maximizing. So it's
yeah.
an equals function xi, x1 plus x2 plus x3 in this world.
Yes.
Which, so I would say that we are using the...
you're in this case.
To minimize this cost is essentially as maximizing the same with the minus 1, considering the concrete case, right?
If you're thinking about minimizing.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, fair enough. But so what I'm saying is that this is something different from the paper of Gambo on the sum of xi squared, right? Or am I
no, because the way I wrote it down is they're maximizing something like this, right? So they're maximizing a convex function of the sum.
Or even in Gambo.
Well,
okay.
The way I wrote it in the original paper, it was probably backwards. Yeah. 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 Right. Right. Okay. So, so I was saying this thing's optimal for its marginals, and I thought that was sort of funny because this cost function or this surplus function h of the sum is nice in a lot of ways. And if you sort of make naive generalizations of this twist and non-degeneracy conditions, these conditions that give you nice solutions in the two marginal case, well, this thing's going to satisfy them, right? Because this matrix is invertible. And if you map like x2 to the differential with respect to x1 or anything like that, you still, I mean, that thing's still one-to-one. Okay, so this tells you something different is going on in the higher marginal case. So I wanted to show one more example, and this is an example from an economics problem called hedonic pricing. And this is a problem a little bit like what I was talking about in the beginning with plumbers and carpenters and everything. But now instead of having one company that's trying to assign teams, say that you have a lot of consumers, and each consumer wants to build a house. And so each consumer wants to hire a carpenter, hire an electrician, hire a plumber, and have those people work on his house. And so the consumer wants, you know, they have preferences over the type of house they want built, and they want to pay as little as possible for it. And each tradesman sort of has preferences over types of houses that they want to work on, and they want to be paid as much as possible for it. And so it turns out that if you look for an equilibrium in this market, it's equivalent to solving a hedonic, or it's equivalent to solving a multi-marginal optimal transportation problem. And so this is due to Chiappuri, McCann, and Nesheim. This equivalence, as well as another paper by Carlier and Eklund. And it turns out that the surplus function that you're working with there is given by, you take the soup of the sum of some function fi, xi, z. And so z is in some external space. And this is from I equals 1 to m. And so in the example I just described, you can think about z as the space of possible houses that could be built. And you could think about the fi at xi of z as sort of the preference that tradesperson xi has to work on house z. And so finding an equilibrium is equivalent to solving this optimal transportation problem. And it turns out that the signature of g here, or of g bar as I called it, is always, okay, well, let's assume that the ni's are always equal to sum. Let's assume they're all the same. So the signature of G bar here turns out to be N, M minus 1, N, 0. I won't say that, but I'll just say under mild conditions. So basically under conditions that make this thing smooth so that you can actually talk about these mixed second order partials. I'll just say under mild conditions. Okay, so in this case, you actually get an n-dimensional solution, just essentially just because of sort of the structure of this surplus function. So, okay, so I've talked a lot about the dimension of the solution, which is only one of the questions I wrote down in the beginning. So I'll say something quickly about Monge solutions and uniqueness of these gammas. So because of examples like this one here, you're going to need some sort of strong conditions to ensure that you have Monge solutions, right? Because, I mean, if you just assume things like twist and non-degeneracy, you can get into things like this. And so the condition that I found that works turns out to be pretty complicated. So I'm just going to state it for m equals 3, but that'll at least give a flavor of what happens. Okay, so this is for the 3 marginal case. And so we're going to assume that the first marginal satisfies this usual regularity condition. And I'm going to assume that S is what I call 1-3 twisted. And so by that I mean you take X3 and you map it to the differential with respect to X1 of S, where X1 and X2 are fixed. And so I assume this thing is injective. And I'm also going to assume 1-3 non-degenerate. And so by that, you can probably guess what I mean. But I just mean you take this symmetric bilinear form and you assume that it's non-degenerate at any point. So assume this is non-degenerate. And I'm going to assume that, right, so now the stronger condition is, well, I'm going to assume that M2 is equal to, right, so I'm still assuming all the dimensions are the same here. I'm going to assume that M2 is actually equal to Rn. I don't really need that. A Riemannian manifold would be enough. So assume that it's equal to Rn or that it's Riemannian. But just the second manifold. I'm not assuming this on the first and third one. And now, I'm going to take 2 points, x1 and x1 bar in M1. I'm going to take a point in M2, and I'm going to take 2 points in the last manifold, x3 and x3 bar. And I'm going to construct construct a bilinear form. So what I construct is d squared x2 x3 s times d squared x1 x3 s, but I take the inverse of this guy, times d squared x1 x3. And I evaluate, that's at s, I evaluate this thing at x1 x2 x3. And now I add on the second derivative with respect to x2, evaluated at the point x1 bar, x2, x3 bar. And I subtract off the same thing at x1, x2, x3. So no bars here. And I assume this thing's bigger than 0. And the conclusion is now, yeah, just write the last line and then I'll lift it up. The conclusion is that you get a Monge solution and that solution is unique. So this form that I've written down is just a form, if I'd written it down correctly, would just be a bilinear form on the second manifold producted with itself. And so it's an ugly looking condition, but it turns out to work for certain surpluses. Like if I take things like this where d squared h is bigger than zero, it turns out that this thing and this thing cancel, so I just get this thing left, which is positive. And it's positive with some room, right? If I have like a uniform lower bound on this thing, so if like in the Gangbone-Schweitzer case where each one of these is basically the identity, then it's positive with some room, so I can make C2 perturbations of these surplus functions, and I'll still get Monge solutions and uniqueness. And it's also, if I take like a bilinear cost on Rn, so if I take like x1 times a matrix times x3 plus x2 times a matrix times x3 plus x2, whatever one I'm missing, then I don't get any of these things. I don't get any unmixed second order partials. And this thing just becomes the product of the three matrices. And so it turns out if that product is symmetric and positive, then it turns out you can show that this is actually equivalent to the surplus function Gangbone-Schweitzer considered after changing coordinates. But if it's not symmetric and positive definite, it's not equivalent, and so you get something new there as well. Okay, so I think I'm more or less out of time, so I'll stop.
What do you mean
by the right?
So
there's certainly measures where if I do this case, I always get this nasty signature. But there's certainly measures for that case where I get lower dimensional solutions. Oh, can I? Are you looking at the top? Oh no! Oh no! Because no other member of capital G gives you anything better for this guy, right? It can't, because otherwise you couldn't have these higher dimensional. Yeah. Considered it, and I have some guesses about what happens, but I don't have anything solid. Yeah.
And in the hedonic case, you know conditions on Fi that give you that condition?
That gives me, this condition. Yeah, and they turn out, so somehow they turn out to be not as strong as you think they'd have to be, because this condition looks strong. But this first piece, that I wrote down is actually equivalent to having G bar have a nice signature. And so the hedonic thing, you always have G bar having a nice signature. And so it turns out some not too much stronger conditions actually let you have this thing positive.
vastly.